Thanks for joining us. I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Israel imposes new restrictions on Palestinians after a gunman kills 8 Israeli seminary students. South American presidents prepare to face off after Colombia attacks rebels inside Ecuador, and Venezuela masses troops on the Colombian border. And China's Darfur envoy says linking the situation in Sudan to the Beijing Olympics is not reasonable. Joining me to discuss these stories and more on the Friday News Roundup, Tom Jelton of NPR, Moises Naim of Foreign Policy Magazine, and Paul Starobin of National Journal. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
The phone number here is 1-800-433-8850. Our email address is drshow@wmu.org. We'd love to hear from you during the course of the programme. Moises Naim, what do we know about the man who killed 8 Israelis in Jerusalem yesterday?
We still don't know much. We know that he's a lone shooter that used a Kalashnikov, entered into what is the Merkaz Harav, a yeshiva, a religious school that it's widely regarded as the birthplace of religious Zionism. And he started firing at students in the library, killing 8 and injuring about 10 more, that several of which are of whom are still in critical care and in doubt if they survive. This is very important, very symbolic. It's both the place where it took place, and also is the it breaks a sense of relative peace and security that had been become more or less the norm in Jerusalem. This is the first attack, I think, in 4 years. Inside the city, and that is creating again a very important backlash at the time in which Secretary Rice was visiting to spearhead and energize peace talks between the Israeli government and the Palestinians.
Paul Starobin, Hamas has not claimed the attack, but it has praised it.
Yes, they have.
They've actually claimed it.
They claimed credit for it. And part of the worry here is that the attacker came from East Jerusalem. So this has always been the real nightmare for the Israelis living within Israel proper now, you know, not in the occupied territories, that you would have an intensified terrorist movement taking root within, you know, Israel proper. And, you know, how do you deal with that? The Israeli, the Shin Bet, the domestic security police have dealt with it over these last 4 or 5 years. But, you know, this raises questions of whether they can continue to do that.
Tom Jelton, the peace talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians were already extremely fragile. So far, the Israeli government is saying that it won't pull out of them because of this attack. But this must put a huge amount of pressure on those talks, doesn't it?
It does, Cathy. And I think that you can make the argument that Hamas actually has orchestrated a number of developments in order to sabotage those talks. Those talks were not between the United States and Hamas. Hamas is not a party to them at all. The United States refuses to deal with Hamas, as does the government of Israel.
Which is what European leaders said after the attack, that this was clearly an arrow at the heart of the peace talks.
Well, I think it is, and it's an arrow. And Hamas did announce this morning that it is taking responsibility for this attack. And I think that part of the idea was to make it impossible for either Abbas or for Israel to continue with these peace talks. Now, Israel will be tempted to retaliate, and if Israel retaliates, that's going to make it, of course, much more difficult to proceed with talks. So it was, unfortunately, I think it was a smart move by Hamas to really, as you say, put a dagger in the peace talks.
Moses, it's Friday, so it's the day of prayers for Muslims, of course, in the area. Would you expect, once this day is over, to see how the Israelis are going to retaliate against this?
The practice has been for strong retaliations on the part of the Israelis. This is also happening in a week in which the Israelis had launched a major military initiative in Gaza in response to an escalation of the rocket attacks launched from Gaza into Israel using a new type of rockets that are of a longer range. And in that military operation, about 100 Palestinians and many civilians have also died. So what we are, again, in this vicious circle of attacks and retaliation, that is the tragic vicious circle that in the Middle East. So I think we have to expect a retaliation from Israel. And again, peace talks in the midst of these dynamics just acquire a very, very strange, difficult, but at the same time indispensable urgency.
Paul, do you think we could see the Israelis going back into Gaza?
Well, I mean, we could, but, you know, they were just there, and then it spurred this very familiar dynamic where there were all these widespread condemnations all over the world, almost, of you know, the civilian, you know, casualties, you know, disproportionate action by Israel, United States more in Israel's corner. Israel pulls back, and then we see this. I think there's enormous frustration, you know, within Israel itself about how to deal with this. They keep hoping that they can knock down Hamas as a player here and take it out somehow, but they haven't been able to do that, and there's no sign that Hamas is, you know, if anything, they may be, you know, strengthened as a result of all of this.
But meanwhile, Tom, a coalition of British human rights group, I think it was 8 of them, described the humanitarian situation in Gaza at its worst point since 1967.
That's right. Israel has made it very difficult to provide any kind of services to Gaza, and you've got a big, desperate population there. And the more that Israel takes this attitude or policy, justified though it may be from the Israeli point of view, the more it just enrages the people in Gaza. And, you know, one of the sad sights yesterday was to see thousands of residents, civilians in Gaza, actually cheering the news that this operative had carried out this attack in Jerusalem. So just gives you an idea of how bad the situation is.
And clearly the poor humanitarian situation in Gaza drives Palestinians who are living there into the arms of Hamas, which is an organization which at various points has been reasonably successful in offering some sorts of social services. But to what extent do Palestinians in Gaza and in the West Bank indeed say, we know that when there is an attack like this, we will suffer retaliation from the Israelis and we're fed up with it?
Well, it doesn't. I think it's a very complicated situation because they may in fact feel that way. However, they look at Hamas, and Hamas in fact seems to be less corrupt in the view of many Palestinians than the Palestinian Authority. They've actually done a better job of providing social services. And when they're in this situation, I think they become more dependent on Hamas for those social services. So while the logic that you refer to may be there, and there may be Palestinians that think that way, I don't think that we can predict that this cycle is going to lead Palestinians in Gaza to be more upset, more fed up with Hamas.
I think Washington has consistently underestimated the situation just in terms of the kind of logic you're describing. I mean, they were surprised when Hamas won the election. They seem to be surprised that Hamas has survived as well as it had, that there is this kind of emotional support. The kind of dynamic where the people would get fed up with Hamas has simply not emerged. If anything, it seems like we have a civil war type situation that is intensifying.
Okay, meanwhile, let's talk about what's happened in Iraq this week, which has been another violent week when we thought we were seeing a lull in the violence in Iraq. But this week we had twin bomb attacks in Baghdad. Moises, what can you tell us about them?
And those are the most cruel of attacks because they are sequenced bombs. They first put a bomb and then when people go to the rescue of the victims, then another bomb explodes, even a larger one, and then killing the responders and the people trying to help others that are injured. This is the largest escalation we have seen of violence in Baghdad, and then there was another attack in the north in Mosul for a while. It is also a week.
So the idea that the insurgency has been dealt some sort of a blow by the presence of more U.S. troops is suffering a little bit of credibility this week.
Well, but we need to see if this is becomes a trend or this is just an event. It may be that this is just a bomb or two, as I said, or, and not part of a wave of escalations and an eruption of violence there. But this is also the week in which President Ahmadinejad visited Iraq, the Iranian president, in what has been described by several observers as a victory lap, went to Baghdad and met with the government.
And said that the U.S., what did he say? The America is irrelevant in this region, I think were his
words.
Yes,
he said that, and American presence adds to the country's instability and violence, he said. He said the people of this area get nothing from the occupation here except damage, sabotage, destruction, insults, and degradation. He met with the Jalal Talibani, the Iraqi president, with Adel Abdul Mahdi, the vice president, who's a Shiite, and several others, including Nouri Kamal al-Maliki, the prime minister. What's important here, however, is to also stress that the internal situation that he faces in Iran is not perfect. Despite booming oil prices and Iran's exports, the Iranian economy is not doing well. And inflation is high, there are shortages of very basic goods, and there is all sorts of disgruntled population in Iraq. So stressing the victory, so to speak, in Iraq also plays to the internal, to his internal domestic problems in Iran.
Moses Naim is editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine. This is the news roundup of the Diane Rehm Show. We'll be back just after this break to speak more about the situation in the Middle East, sanctions against Iran, the Russian elections, the situation in the Andes. We'll be back also looking at the latest on Darfur. Please stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. You've joined the Friday News Roundup with Tom Jelton, Moses Naim and Paul Starabin. We were talking just before the break about President Ahmadinejad's visit to Iraq this week and those bomb attacks in Iraq. It was also, Tom Jelton, the week that the US announced it's withdrawing 2,000 soldiers from Baghdad. What kind of difference will that make on the security situation in Baghdad, do you think?
Well, Kathy, the surge in the additional U.S. troops has just been one of the factors that has led to a reduction of the violence. Probably the two most important factors, or two equally important factors, are the so-called Sunni awakening, with, where former Sunni insurgents have turned against al-Qaeda in Iraq. That has been extremely important. And this bombing that we were referring to earlier probably is the product of al-Qaeda in Iraq, the basically the outside Sunni element. And the question, the big question is, will the Sunnis who the United States has worked with in bringing about the reduction of violence, will they continue to be allied with the United States? And what they are looking for, and what I think they're upset by, is they're looking for more progress in reconciliation between the Shia and the Sunni. They're looking for more of a to feel that they have more of a place in the government. I think that the you know, visit by Ahmadinejad this week has underscored the sort of the Shiite predominance in the government. And that's exactly the kind of thing that is going to make the Sunnis nervous. And they have not seen enough progress in the government reaching out to Sunni elements. So this is a very fragile moment. And, you know, if U.S. troops withdraw a number right now, I think that will just underscore the fragility of the situation there and make clear that there are a number of things that can still go wrong.
I thought it was very interesting, Paul, watching Ahmadinejad's visit there, the way it was choreographed with all those red carpet events, the bands playing so different from President Bush's earlier visit, which was kept confined in a security bubble that he had to be inside.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, whether it's President Bush or Condoleezza Rice, any of these, you know, they kind of fly in. Under the cover of the dark of night, you know, nobody knows they're there until they pop up at a press conference. I mean, the propaganda value, I think, of this visit of Iran's president was that he allowed himself to be seen in a much more visible, open way. He made this sort of convoy trip from the airport in a kind of open fashion. I mean, there was this statement here that the subtext was that, look, I am safer here. I am more welcome in this society than the American, you know, occupier.
Right.
Is.
Who really matters in Baghdad these days?
And I think everyone got that message, including, as Tom is saying, you know, the Sunni who are quite concerned about the Iranian influence in Iraq.
But he was in a bit of a bubble himself. I mean, he was expected to go to the south, and he did not go to the south. And, you know, people back in Iran will wonder, why didn't he go to the south to visit the traditional Shiite shrines there? And I think it's because he had his own security concerns, just like President Bush or Condi Rice would
have. And another security concern that perhaps President Ahmadinejad has, and perhaps even more an economic concern that he might have, was the UN Security Council this week in Moses, which agreed to a third round of sanctions against Iran. Do these sanctions have more bite to him than previous
Indeed,
rounds?
And they are multi-layered, and they are getting top of the others. And these are sanctions that authorize inspection of cargo to and from Iran, to any vessel suspected of carrying prohibited equipment. It tightens the monitoring of Iranian financial institutions. And very importantly, it extends travel bans and freezes assets against people and companies involved in suspected of being involved or involved in a nuclear program. This is very important also because it was an initiative sponsored by the United Kingdom and France. And it was supported by all the Security Council members except Indonesia.
Well, that's very interesting because we're going to get on to the fallout from the Russian elections in just a moment, talking to Paul. But why did Moscow come on board with this round of sanctions when they've been so reluctant previous rounds?
That's unclear, and at least it's unclear to me, but it's certainly part. There is a widespread coalition that is concerned about Iran's nuclear program that now even transcends the frictions and tensions that exist between Russia and the rest of the world. But what's very important is that to realize that this comes on the heels of the release of the National Intelligence Estimate in the United States. A few months ago, I think, a month or so ago, the National Intelligence Council released a report in the United States essentially saying that Iran was not developing a nuclear program, that they had a peaceful nuclear program, but not a military one. And that, of course, created all sorts of reactions from European countries that were convinced that indeed that was not the case and that Iran was developing a nuclear military weapons program. And this, as we can see, this round of sanctions and a very important meeting that took place early in the week at the International Atomic Energy
Agency.
In which the agency, which is widely regarded as objective and technical and impartial, essentially made the claim that Iran was indeed developing a nuclear military program.
Let's talk about those Russian elections. Russia has a new president-elect, Dmitry Medvedev, whose name I always find difficult to pronounce. Paul Starobin, you've met him, so I hope you can pronounce his name better than I have. What's he like?
Or better than Hillary Clinton.
than Hillary Clinton, who messed it up on the campaign trail.
Yes, Medvedev, whatever. I think Medvedev is right. Dmitry, friends might call him Dima. I did meet him. I met him last year in June in Moscow in the Kremlin in his office on the third floor of the building that used to be the headquarters for Lenin. And he has in his office a nice chess set. He's a very small man, which is interesting because Vladimir Putin is not a large man, and he chose somebody who is even smaller, 5'4".
Nor is Nicolas Sarkozy, so I wonder if we're seeing a trend here in small European strong leaders.
Well, and his strength is one of the questions. I mean, Putin has this sort of animal instinct that he projects even when you meet him. It's almost like shaking hands with a wolf. Medvedev is, you know, he's a lawyer. He, you know, he's very reflective about Russian history. We talked about the difficulties of achieving democracy in the context of Russian history. He drew a diagram for me, you know, where he said, well, here's the Russian business elite. Here's the Russian political elite. Here's the intelligentsia. We must all be together on the same page so Russia does not fracture. I mean, this is not, you know, checks and balances, you know, sort of American Anglo style. So he is a Russian, and I think it's important to understand that because some are promoting him as a more liberal, you know, variation of Putin. And the other thing I would say is that, you know, he's part of this larger team, you know, which is Team Putin. And Putin himself is very much, you know, in the mix now. And it's not clear what the division of responsibility is going to be between these two.
I mean, what's your hunch since the election? How long do you think Dmitry Medvedev is going to be happy to live under the shadow of Vladimir Putin?
Well, I don't think whether he is happy or not, I think he is acceptive and accommodating of the role for the time being. And I think it will be up to Putin, who really is his master and mentor, to decide, you know, at what point Medvedev gets more responsibility. I don't take all that seriously some of these sort of formal divisions of responsibility that we see in the Russian, you know, constitution and so forth. I mean, this election itself was rather, you know, a sham. They did not allow the real opposition figures to run. So they are very much, you know, Team Putin kind of controlling things here. Medvedev may come into his own after several years if Putin decides that, you know, he's had maybe a bit enough of the sort of day-to-day kind of management of things. But at the moment, they're both stressing, you know, continuity with what, you know, the vision that Putin has sketched for Russia.
Tom Gelton, it seems to me that after Sunday's result, which, let's face it, everybody could have forecast in advance, there was relatively little international outcry about how undemocratic the Russian election had been.
Ken, I think that's partly because of the margin of victory. It was so large. And I don't think that, in spite of the fact that I think all the neutral observers did regard this as an undemocratic election, I don't think there's a feeling among people who know Russia well that somehow this disguised some widespread opposition or dissent with Putin. By all indications, Putin seems to be relatively popular. I mean, Russia is doing very well economically. Of course, that's due largely to high oil prices. But it's not as if the opposition is really strong in Russia.
But at the same time, Europe's main election monitoring group, the OSCE, didn't even turn up to monitor the Russian election because it said it couldn't operate there.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens this weekend when Angela Merkel goes to Moscow. And she is one of the few European leaders to really express some concern about the quality of the Russian political process. And she has said that she intends to bring this issue up when she, and she is, as an East German, she speaks Russian. She has had good relations in the past. She's got some credibility. She says she intends to bring this up when she's there this weekend.
Moses.
And what's interesting is I agree with Tom that Putin is substantially popular and people like him.
So although this might not have been a democratic process, it was the result of the
democratic
will.
It was not a democratic process. No one would argue that this was an election that is fair and transparent. So the question is, why did he feel so insecure as to have to develop all these dirty tricks, some of which are quite amazing and went beyond the pale? Because he could have won an election more or less in a competitive process. Yet they decided to rig it in a way that it's quite embarrassing, that even calls into question, you know, why bother? Why even have an election if you're going to rig it and mess with it in this way? And that's a very interesting question. And
Paul?
Well, I think it gets at a fundamental Russian ambivalence, which is age old, about whether they are part of Europe or whether they're more part of, you know, sort of Eurasia. And, you know, if they're part of Europe, then they're supposed to have elections. At the same time, I don't think you can underestimate the level of insecurity and even paranoia in the Kremlin. They fear another colored revolution. It may seem absurd from our perspective, but look what happened in Ukraine. Look what happened in Kyrgyzstan. Look what happened in the Rose Revolution in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. Russia believes that America and its agents, you know, through these non-governmental organizations, are spreading their tentacles, you know, within the reaches of the former Soviet Union, and they are gathering, you know, to oppose the Putin regime, and they are determined to resist, you know, and squelch any, you know, possibility that could happen.
I'm Katty Kay. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join us, please do call 1-800-433-8850. I'm going to go to the phones in just a moment. I wanted to pick up on something there, Paul. I mean, to what extent is Putin's popularity based on the economic success that Russians are enjoying, which is also based on record high oil and gas prices? If they were to decline, would Medvedev have a problem on his hands?
Yeah, absolutely. I tend to view the popularity as somewhat thinly based. I don't think that Putin is so genuinely, you know, liked for his, you know, qualities of person. I think people think he has brought a modicum of order to Russia, and they've had this kind of petro, you know, fueled boom. But I wouldn't, you know, change in Russia happens like a thunderclap, and it could happen again.
Okay, let's get on to Colombia. Just before we go to the phones, Tom Gelton, South American presidents could be facing off today at an international summit in the Dominican Republic. How do the leaders of Colombia, Venezuela, and Ecuador see the conflict unfolding, do you think, on their borders?
Well, Cuddy, I think the issue here in Latin America, and it's a very old one, and Moises can speak to it very eloquently, is that Latin countries are very sensitive about issues of national sovereignty for understandable reasons, given their history. And I think that's the issue that comes shining through. And that explains why Ecuador's very vigorous protests about the incursion into Ecuadorian territory really has some resonance in Latin America. You know, among the governments that were very critical of this was Mexico, which is now not only close to the United States, it's now ruled by a conservative party. But to many countries, to many governments, this just brings back fears that their own borders are too soft. And I think that there is also a concern about what, you know, is known in the sort of the counterinsurgency literature as ungoverned spaces. Many of these governments have borders, have areas that are very hard to govern along their borders. And I think that they all have concerns about somehow finding a way to retain control over their territory in these areas where they don't have a strong presence. So these, if you look at it in that context, I think that explains.
Okay, let's go to the phones now to Luis in Kensington, Maryland. Luis, you have a question on this issue.
I just heard the statement about the unsecure borders and the not controllable lands. The only problem is that the guerrillas in Colombia have been controlling large portions of Colombia, some portions of Venezuela, some portions of Bolivia, some portions of any neighboring country, because it's very difficult to police every last little place. Unfortunately, the president from Venezuela and some of the others have now decided that it's okay because they're profiting from the drug trade. It is okay because it might advance their own politics in the region. Mr. Chavez thinks he is Simon Bolivar, who is going to liberate all five countries again, create a Gran Colombia in the style that Bolivar tried to do many years ago when he was a liberator.
Okay, Luis, I'm just going to interrupt you because I've just had a message here saying that apparently Hugo Chavez has actually called for calm over the crisis at the summit. Is that significant, Moses Nine?
Yes, it is significant, but not surprising. Rattling was never going to become a war there is a lot of posturing, a lot of hypocrisy in all the process.
Given the sensitivities that Tom was speaking about just now, the Colombians must have felt they were going to get something very significant by going after Raul Reyes. And there is this story in the Washington Post this morning about what they picked up during this raid.
That was a bonus, because what they picked up was a laptop and all sorts of materials. And inside the laptop computer, they found all sorts of information, incriminating information, apparently, that shows that President Chavez has been actively supporting the FARC guerrillas, as has also President Correa of Ecuador. So in many ways, their noise is a preemptive kind of strike to try to diffuse any information that can be leaked or come from the information gathered by from the computer. This is a strike against the FARC, which is a guerrilla movement that has been torturing Colombia now for almost 40, 50 years. Mm-hmm. They initially started as an ideological left-of-center leftist movement, but now they are essentially aligned with the narco-traffickers, and they are enablers of the cocaine production in the region. And these are people that are deeply involved in kidnappings, assassinations, and all kinds of terrorist attacks.
Moises Naim, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine, will be back with more of your questions in comments just after this short break. Please stay listening.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, two scientists make their arguments for and against the existence of God. Richard Dawkins is an evolutionary biologist and atheist. He's the author of the bestseller, The God Delusion. Francis Collins headed the Human Genome Project and is an evangelical Christian. He finds God's plan in the genetic code. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. You've joined the Friday News Roundup. I just wanted to read an email here from Warren, who asks, do you think that the Chavez actions against Colombia are being played as a distraction from the rising internal problems in Venezuela, with reports of rising crime, inflation, economic difficulties, and public dissatisfaction internally? Paul, what do you think? Is the issue with the border a distraction by Venezuela from its own internal problems?
Well, I think in part it is. I mean, we have seen Chavez play so many games with the kind of, you know, rhetoric on issues like this, and one of the things that he's tried to do is frame, you know, Colombia, you know, which the United States is aligned with as a kind of new, you know, Israel in the region. And so I think we're seeing a lot of, you know, bluster on his part. But, you know, if the Colombians have the goods on him now with these documents and things from the laptops, I think he's going to have a lot of, you know, difficult explaining to do.
There's also an email asking about the fate of Ingrid Betancourt. What do we know about her position at the moment, Moses?
She has been captured and kidnapped by the FARC guerrilla movement now for almost 6 years. And in the documents captured in the laptop that was captured in Raul Reyes, which is the second in command of the FARC, there is an exchange that essentially says, we cannot give you Ingrid Betancourt because she's our largest chip. If we give her, we have nothing else left to bargain with.
Sounds ominous for her. Let's go back to the phones now to Jess in Dallas, Texas. Jess, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just got a couple of comments, if you allow me, give me a short time here. One is about the Israeli-Palestinian issue. That, you know, before all this happened here yesterday and last week's Gaza was sieged by Israel and it's continued for a long time. Very little aid and anything can get in and out of Gaza to the point in which the Palestinians, you know, literally went over the border. So that led up to another point in which Israel basically invaded Gaza. And for one reason or another, that's what happened. They invaded Gaza. A lot of bombing went on, and women and children were killed in that incident, which went on for, I think, over a week or something.
Jess, then, do you have a question for the panel on this?
No. I said I only had a comment. But then that led up to yesterday's event, which a couple of people went into a Zionist school, attacked people, killed people in there. So what I'm trying to get the point in is that there's a cause and effect. And a lot of times in the media, we just looked at yesterday's event and said this was an attack on the peace process. But actually, the siege and the invasion of Gaza entirely was an attack on the peace process.
So if I'm understanding Jess right there, what he's getting at and what other callers are getting at, and I'm looking at our list of callers, is that there is a question about what Israel was doing in Gaza in the lead up to this attack, and that the situation in Gaza seems to be driving a sense of desperation amongst the population, Moses.
But let's not forget, following with the cause and effect and the sequence here, let's not forget that Israel left unilaterally Gaza and with the hope that Hamas would become the government and then would worry more about governing and delivering social services and infrastructure and managing the country. Instead, Hamas stuck with a very, very belligerent, you know, the rocket-throwing process.
And it seems that the rockets are getting more effective because they're going further into Israeli territory, Paul.
And there's talk that the Iranians are aiding the Hamas with these rockets and so forth. So what we have is a theater that is not simply, you know, Israelis and, you know, Hamas and Palestine. We have a regional theater here with actors, you know, not contiguous to these territories, also immersing themselves. So Israel feels, you know, doubly justified in defending itself from this kind of multi-pronged attack. And the cause and the effect, indeed, can go back for so long that you know, people, analysts, have difficulty keeping track of it.
We have a lot of calls on this issue. Let's go to Phyllis, who's in Florida. Phyllis.
Oh, yes. I want to speak to this issue right now. Do your guests have any idea about the position of the UN on all this situation? After all, it was the UN who partitioned Palestine to create the state of Israel. And I thought the Gaza Strip remained in Palestine.
Okay, so Phyllis, let's see if Tom, you can clear that up for us.
Well, I think the United Nations has long since proved its inability to deal with the Israeli-Palestinian situation, owing to the very sharp divisions that exist in the international community around anything having to do with Israel. The Security Council couldn't even come up with a resolution condemning the killing yesterday because Libya, which is currently a member of the Security Council, insisted that any condemnation of this shooting include also a condemnation continuation of Israel's incursion into the Gaza last week and the week before, which is what the listeners were referring to. So when you've got this kind of situation, the United Nations is just hamstrung and just can't respond and really hasn't played a significant role in the Israeli-Palestinian situation in years and years.
What role are NGOs and UN aid agency, Moses, playing in Gaza at the moment to try and relieve the humanitarian crisis there? Is there much that they can do in that situation?
They're fundamental. At this point, NGOs and humanitarian efforts are the ones providing for a lot of the food and a lot of the social services and support. A lot of these NGOs are funded by Arab countries, by Iran, and the situation is desperate indeed.
Okay, let's go to Foster, who is in Huntsville, Alabama. Foster, you have a question on the Venezuelan situation.
Yes, hi, this is Foster Perry from Huntsville. A message or a question for Moises Naim. Moises, if the Colombian allegations are proven true in terms of Chavez's connection with the FARC, how do you think that will impact Chavez's popularity in Venezuela?
Chavez's popularity is declining, and is declining for reasons unrelated to its international stance. It's declining because people in Venezuela cannot understand how a country that is so wealthy and with oil at $105 per barrel cannot find milk in the shelves of the supermarkets. There is no chicken, there is no basic staples. Crime has gotten out of hand, and everybody fears going out in the streets because it's a very dangerous situation. He's not governing, in fact. He is essentially spending all of his energy, all of his money, intervening and trying to develop an international image.
I want to address one issue that we haven't got to before we get to the close of the program, which is Darfur. There have been various stories this week about a resurgence of the kinds of attacks that we saw against people in Darfur, led by the Janjaweed, perhaps backed up by Sudanese government gunships. And it does seem that these tactics are being used all over again. Have you heard anything about this, Tom?
Well, Katia, again, you have to look at this in a regional context, and part of the background to this is the rebellion in Chad, and the rebel forces in Darfur are loyal to the government of Chad, and when the president of Chad was facing a rebellion in his territory, some of the rebel groups actually went to his defense, which left a kind of a vacuum in the area that they had under their control. And the government of Sudan wanted to take advantage of that and move in. And there's no secret about the fact that the government of Sudan uses these Janjaweed militias as kind of an advance terror group. And so that was the first thing you saw, is these Janjaweed groups coming back into territory that had been basically vacated by the rebel groups who had moved into Chad. It's an extremely complicated situation, and it just appears that we're now in danger of plunging back into this cycle of violence and suffering that has been so horrible.
Paul, what's the situation of China at the moment vis-a-vis Sudan?
Well, that's, a fascinating element here, because China is one of the major, they're in the country with, they have oil stakes, they've been supplying arms, and they've been coming under a tremendous amount of criticism for a kind of passive, role in this or worse. And so now they're taking the position that they're urging, compromise. There are many things that they could do. I mean, there's supposed to be this major deployment of tens of thousands of peacekeeping forces, but it's been, largely delayed in the Sudan.
We only have 9,000 on the ground.
We only have 9,000 at this point. There's supposed to be something like 26,000. And now China, with the Olympics, coming up this year, I mean, this is a huge, they do not want to have their Olympics party spoiled. And so that is the only real leverage, I think, at this point that a lot of the Western groups have. We saw this with Steven Spielberg, the filmmaker, who was pulled out of the role that he had in the Olympics because he got criticism on this. So we may see China taking a more, active, energetic role to try to do something to stop the kinds of things that we're seeing in Sudan.
Moses, is there any indication that China might be trying to play that more active role? We did have today the Chinese foreign ministry coming out and saying that it was unreasonable to link the Olympics in Beijing with the situation in Darfur. Are they feeling the pressure?
I think they're feeling the pressure. And in fact, Beijing envoy Li Gujin, according to Reuters, defended his country and saying that China was working very, very hard in Sudan to end the fighting. and said that China could serve as a go-between, bringing peace closer and so on. So China is trying hard, and I think Paul is absolutely right that the Olympics and China's international image play a very large role in defining their posture here.
Meanwhile, there was a story that Nick Kristoff had in a column this week in the New York Times saying that the Sudanese government is undercutting the peace agreement in southern Sudan as well, that we may be seeing the same sorts of tactics down there. Do you know anything more about this, Tom?
I don't really know any more about that, Caddy, but it's clear that the Sudanese government has been extremely ambivalent, to say the least, about any of these peace processes and has given only token support to them and has undercut any attempt to sort of turn them from promise into reality.
I'm Caddy Kay. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And do call us, 1-800-433-8850. Those emails keep coming, drshow@wamu.org. We've got a few minutes left on the program. Let's go back to the phones to Barry in Brooklyn, New York. Barry, you're on the air.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
My question has to go with, if the Colombian forces were following the rebels into Ecuador in hot pursuit, and they bombed them from the air, how was it they were able to get the laptop in such good condition and at the same time able to retrieve documents the very next day? I mean, I'm just inquiring because it seems like it's a little discrepancy between what they were saying in public and what is coming forth now.
Okay, Barry, that's a very good question. Moses.
Indeed, a good question, and that has been asked, and the Colombian government has asked both the Organization of American States and Interpol to come and do an investigation and to take a look and do some forensic computer analysis.
They're trying to establish the bona fides of what
they've found.
Yes,
they have asked the Organization of American States, and there is a resolution of the Organization of American States that will send a mission to inspect and evaluate all these claims.
Moses, given the unpopularity of Colombia in the region and how Colombia is seen particularly as a close ally of America, which is not particularly popular in that region, do you think that the kinds of evidence that the Colombians have now found on this computer will make much impact in terms of Venezuela's popularity or Hugo Chavez's popularity regionally?
I said before that there is a great hypocrisy in the conversation amongst countries about this subject because at the end of the day, a lot of presidents that are now denouncing Colombia know that in the facing the same predicament, they would probably have made the same decision. And in fact, Colombia is not as unpopular in the region as it seems. There was, again, an Organization of American States meeting this week in which it was, you know, the Venezuelans and the Ecuadorians wanted a strong, harsh denunciation of Colombia. They couldn't get it from the rest of the region. And there are other countries like Peru and Chile and even Brazil that understand what's the situation and how difficult it is for the Colombians to fight this guerrilla movement and now with the support of President Chavez.
Let's go back to the phones to Alex in Dallas, Texas. Alex, you're joining the program. Alex, can you hear me?
Yes. I have a question about Russia. Since Putin is to become prime minister, who is going to run Russia at this point?
Yeah. you've got Paul Starobin here, both smiling and shaking his head, Alex. I'll put that one straight to him. Who's going to run Russia?
Well, the same people who are already running Russia, who I like to call Team Putin. Team Putin has control over the financial assets at the heights of the commanding economy and oil and gas and defense and aviation and diamonds and automobiles. And they also have control over all of the mechanisms of political power. They're a bit like a clan, although they have a lot of competing influences with each other. And they're probably a rather, you know, greedy and acquisitive bunch as well. So I think this is essentially a kind of team concept, but we can expect occasionally to see a little bit of blood, you know, seeping out of the doors of their closed room meetings.
That puts Washington in a bit of a tricky position, doesn't it, Tom? Who does the White House deal with in Russia now?
Well, I think the United States would like to deal with Medvedev, but the American administration is fully aware, as Paul says, that Putin is continuing to pull the strings, and what matters most is dealing with the person who's got the power, so that'll continue to be Putin. You know, it's traditional for the prime minister in Russia to have a president, the picture of the president on his wall, and Putin has already made clear that he does not intend to put Medvedev's picture on the wall, so that tells you right there that he does not intend to defer to the president.
We had a caller who was on the list, but I'm afraid we didn't get to, who said that all the things that we've been talking about are an indication of why Barack Obama should be elected president of the United States. Before we go, I want to ask all of you, who are all foreign policy experts, who you think would make the most difference to America's standing in the world at the moment and dealing with the complicated foreign policy issues that we've been talking about this hour, Paul Starobin?
Well, certainly Barack Obama would in the first instance, purely from a kind of, you know, public relations and image and public diplomacy perspective. But I think that question tends to be a little bit overdrawn because in the end, you know, when you go around the world and you talk to people, what they talk about are America's actions as a country. You know, the leader, it's all about what this person does.
Moses Naim, briefly.
I tend to agree with that. It's Barack Obama will present a very different view and an image. And there is also, of course, internationally, there's a big issue of the dynastic element of what would happen if Hillary Clinton is elected.
Tom Gelton, two for two.
I agree, but I think sharp change is feared in the world. Instability is the greatest concern in a lot of places, and I think that there would be some concern about a Barack Obama as president.
What I do know is that the world is watching this election very, very closely. Tom Gelton, Moses Naim, Paul Starobin, thank you so much for joining me. I'm Catty Kay, sitting in for Diane Rehm, and thank you all for listening. Have a great weekend.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Emmanuel Tui. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.